Iran that says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Britons take to the streets in several cities to protest against a bill that makes it easier for police to shut down peaceful rallies. And Germany reports more than 18,000 confirmed coronavirus cases and a further 120 new deaths. Welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Tehran has repeatedly made its stance clear. He said the country's definitive policy is to have all U.S. sanctions lifted. Khatibzadeh said only after an effective and verified removal of U.S. sanctions, Tehran would reverse its commitment cut under the deal. The remarks came in response to recent comments by the deputy spokeswoman of the U.S. State Department, Jelena Porter, who said Washington was willing to negotiate the steps Iran needed to take to return to compliance under the JCPOA.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
But an informed Iranian source says that Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Earlier, political commentator Tohid Asadi joined us with his take on Tehran's opposition to a step-by-step approach toward the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
There is an idea that Biden administration had going through the same trajectory that Trump administration did, and it's trying to kind of persuade Iran for going for further negotiations with no tangible outcome for Tehran. And with that said, I don't think at the time being, under the current circumstances, Iran is going to be that much for this proposal. When it comes to Tehran, currently speaking, any kind of proposal related to JCPOA coming from the United States is just for the sake of wasting the time and nothing in practice in return. So in this context, I think Iran has got this sense that the United States, either under Trump administration or Biden administration, is not a country to be trusted in any kind of negotiation.
The Iranian president has called on people to strictly abide by health protocols to tackle a new spike in coronavirus infections. Hassan Rouhani says a fourth wave of the disease has struck some provinces, which may grip several other areas if health protocols are not observed. He said shopping sprees in the run-up to the Persian New Year and trips during the holidays are mainly to blame for the possible nationwide surge in the pandemic. Iran has reported 123 more daily coronavirus fatalities, taking the overall tally to nearly 63,000. More than 11,000 new cases were also posted. Now that brings to nearly 2 million the total number of infections in the country. Now to Bahrain, where people there have staged rallies to demand an immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners amid the coronavirus pandemic. The demonstrations took place in the capital, Manama, and 18 other towns and villages across the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Protesters carried signs reading that political prisoners are facing the threat of COVID-19 in overcrowded cells. Right activists have also sounded the alarm that the respiratory disease is spreading among prisoners. According to the London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, dozens of COVID cases have been recorded among inmates in Bahrain. Bahrain's public prosecution office has announced that 126 prisoners will be free to serve their terms outside of jail under electronic monitoring because of the pandemic. The country has registered some 150,000 infections and over 500 deaths. The Israeli regime has razed the dozens of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank during the past 2 weeks. Local Palestinian media reported that 26 Palestinian homes were destroyed by Israeli forces. Structures were demolished in the cities of Nablus and Jericho in the occupied West Bank. The buildings were torn down during the second half of March. 34 Palestinians, including 15 children, were left homeless as a result. Israeli authorities demolished Palestinian homes on a regular basis under different pretexts. They also sometimes order the Palestinian owners to destroy their own homes or to pay demolition costs. Human rights groups and Palestinians say the regime's demolition drive is part of its expansionist agenda. A number of Israeli settlers have visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque under the protection of Israeli police. That is while Israel has frequently prevented Palestinians from entering the holy site. We discuss the matter in our news review program.
Israeli settlers have forced their way into Jerusalem's Flashpoint Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to celebrate a Jewish holiday. Palestinians have condemned the move, calling it provocative. Mona Kandil has more.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for a way to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Shafar Rahmani is a Palestinian writer and political analyst who joins us from Perth. We also have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign who joins us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Mick Napier, let me first start with you. Tell us the reason why Palestinians are so outraged when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and how they are banned by Israel by going and praying in that mosque time and again.
Well, as your correspondent said, she used the word daily attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It may not be daily, but it's pretty close. The pressure is constant, and I think it comes from two sources. One is the extremist groups in the Israeli political spectrum who make no secret of the fact that they wish to take over and destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a so-called third temple. And they're quite prepared to pursue that agenda. It's interesting, by the way, that the Temple Mount Institute receives funding from the Israeli government to pursue this agenda, as well as from Jewish billionaires in the USA. So this is a constant pressure from that element of the Israeli political spectrum. But Netanyahu also has to worry about them because they have allies within his government and his immediate competition. The recent elections marked a decisive shift to the Zionist right, i.e. to the elements who openly call for the expulsion of all Palestinians, every last one, and their replacement with Jewish settlers. So Netanyahu's looking over his shoulders at these people. He doesn't want to be outflanked by people who claim, as Gantz did in a previous election, that he could kill more Palestinians than Netanyahu did, or that they can be harder on Palestinians in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So it's also part of the wider picture. The Zionists make no secret of it. They wish to take over 100% of Palestine with no Palestinians, and that does not exempt the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yeah, Jafar Rahmani, when you take a look at some of the testimonies from Palestinians, you know, they're very outraged, and at the same time, they're very saddened because they can't pray at the mosque. One particular testimony that I'm reading here says that in a period of, let me make sure I have the figure right, in a period of, 120 days, was it? I don't have that. Okay, in a matter of 6 months, only a number of four or five times this particular person was able to pray there. And yet it says in this particular testimony you have settlers that go in there once in a while, you have Israeli journalists that actually go in there, you have tourists that actually can go inside the mosque, but Palestinians can't. What is the reason for this restriction that the Israeli regime places on Palestinians when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
There is nothing for me to add to what your other guests have said other than to change one word. it's a constant plan. It's not a program. It's a plan. It's the original plan of the Zionists to overtake Palestine, to steal our land and natural resources, and kick us out. When I was 5 years old in 1948, the message was, leave or die. The message now is kill them all. And Al-Aqsa Mosque is in their sight, and they have been doing this for years and years, especially in the last 4 years since Trump assumed power in Washington. And every single year during this time, Passover, there's a total shutdown of the entire landmass of Palestine for 10 days. The Palestinians cannot go anywhere or do anything during Passover. Al-Aqsa Mosque is one aspect of this. And shame on all the Muslim countries, especially those who hurried to normalize with Israel, that they have abandoned Al-Aqsa Mosque. But we, the Palestinians, are willing and able to defend it to the last man standing.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Jafar Rahmani, Palestinian writer and political analyst from Perth, and thank you, Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Edinburgh. And that brings us to the end of this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Now to the UK, where Brits have taken to the streets in multiple cities to voice their protests against a bill that makes it easier for police to shut down peaceful rallies. Rallies have been staged in 25 cities, including in London, Liverpool, and Bristol. The event in London was held despite police warning against holding rallies. The protests are part of the so-called Kill the Bill rallies, which call for the repeal of the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill. The legislation currently under review in the British Parliament allows police officers to take tougher measures against protesters. Opponents of the bill say it can be used to curtail individual freedom and violate people's right to protest. Meanwhile, a number of European countries have reported more coronavirus infections and deaths as the continent is grappling with the pandemic and its more contagious variants. Ukraine has reported over 20,000 new COVID-19 infections. This has been the highest one-day tally since the pandemic hit the country more than a year ago. The health ministry also confirmed nearly 400 deaths. Now, the government has already imposed lockdowns in several large cities, including in the capital, Kiev, to contain the virus. Meanwhile, Germany registered more than 18,000 new cases and 120 deaths. The country's total infections stand at over 2.87 million. Its death toll is also nearing 77,000. Elsewhere, Russia reported over 9,000 new deaths, more than 2,000 of them in the capital, Moscow. The country's death toll also rose to more than 100,000. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
A national non-profit revealed that testing commissioned by the group, as well as separate analyses conducted by Massachusetts officials, show samples of an aerially sprayed pesticide used by the Commonwealth and at least 25 other states to control mosquito-borne illnesses contain toxic substances that critics called forever chemicals. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading "Tests Reveal Toxic Forever Chemicals in Aerial Pesticide Showered Over Millions of Acres in the United States." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A national nonprofit revealed that testing commissioned by the group, as well as separate analyses conducted by Massachusetts officials, show samples of an aerially sprayed pesticide used by the Commonwealth and at least 25 other states to control mosquito-borne illnesses contain toxic substances that critics call forever chemicals. Officially known as PFAS and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, this group of man-made chemicals, including PFOA, PFOS, and GenX, earned the nickname because they do not break down in the environment and build up in the body. PFAS has been linked to suppressed immune function, cancers, and other health issues. Lawmakers and regulators at various levels of government have worked to clean up drinking water contaminated by PFAS. The newly released results of pesticide testing by public employees for environmental responsibility, or PEER, and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, MADEP, generated alarm about the effectiveness of such efforts. In Massachusetts, communities are struggling to remove PFAS from their drinking water supplies, while at the same time, we may be showering them with PFAS from the skies and roads. PEER Science Policy Director Kyla Bennett, a scientist and attorney formerly with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, said in a statement on Tuesday, December 1st, "The frightening thing is that we do not know how many pesticides, herbicides, or even disinfectants contain PFAS," added Bennett, who arranged for the testing. PEER found patents showing chemical companies using PFAS in these products, and recent articles discussed the variety of pesticides that contain PFAS as either an active or an inert ingredient. The product tested initially by PEER and subsequently MADEP, once the nonprofit alerted the department of its findings, is Anvil 10+1, produced by the Illinois company Clark. Karen Larson, Clark's vice president of government affairs, told the Boston Globe that when this was first brought to our attention, we conducted an internal inquiry of our manufacturing and supply chain to ensure that PFAS was not an ingredient in the production, manufacturing, or distribution of either the active or inactive ingredients of Anvil. No PFAS ingredients are used in the formulation of Anvil, nor in the production of any source material in Anvil. PFAS components are not added at any point in the production of Anvil, she said. Larson added that while it is unclear why the Clark pesticide contained PFAS, the company will continue to work closely with the EPA to conduct the testing. PEER Executive Director Tim Whitehouse detailed the recent testing results in a letter sent last week to MADEP Commissioner Martin Suberg that called for the halting use of Anvil 10+10, ensuring any replacement does not contain forever chemicals, and requiring pesticide companies to comprehensively test their products for PFAS. This fall, PEER conducted several tests for PFAS of a 2.5-gallon jug of Anvil 10+10, the pesticide used in aerial spraying programs of Massachusetts and many other states across the United States of America. We'll be right back. The test revealed that Anvil 10 plus 10 contains roughly 250 parts per trillion of perfluorooctanic acid, that is PFOA, and 260 to 500 ppt of hexafluoropropylene oxide dimer acid, that is HFPODA, a Gen X replacement for PFOA. Both these results are hovering around the detection limits of the laboratory's equipment, but there is no doubt that these PFAS are in the intesticide. While PFAS may be useful when added to pesticides as surfactants, dispersants, and antifoaming agents, it is unclear whether the PFAS found in Anvil 10 plus 10 is an ingredient added by the manufacturer, contained in one of the ingredients supplied to Anvil's manufacturer by other companies, or whether it is a containment from the manufacturing storage process. Moreover, since we were only able to test for 36 PFAS out of the 9,252 on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's inventory, it is impossible to know how many other PFAS might be in the Anvil 10 plus 10, the researchers added. When PEER obtained its first positive PFAS results on Anvil 10 plus 1, we immediately contacted DEP because of the far-reaching implications, the researchers said. MADEP independently tested 9 samples of Anvil 10 plus 10 from 5 different containers and found 8 different PFAS, including PFOA and PFOS. Some PFAS levels were over 700 ppt. As such, there appears to be no doubt that there are PFAS in the pesticide Massachusetts has chosen for mosquito control. White House noted that Massachusetts aerially sprayed 2.2 million acres with Anvil 10 plus 10 last year and more than 200,000 acres this year. The Globe explained that most of the spraying has been done in southeastern part of the state where EEE, a rare but deadly mosquito-borne disease, has been most prevalent. The EPA, which has been lambasted by lawmakers as well as environmental and public health advocates for its handling of PFAS contamination on a national scale, is working on an analytical method to detect the forever chemicals in pesticides and plans to conduct its own tests of Anvil 10 plus 10, according to the newspaper. There are significant unanswered questions about the data currently available, Dave Deegan, a spokesperson for the federal agency's offices in New England, told the Globe. EPA will continue to work closely with and support the state on the issue. Bennett and other critics of the EPA's response to PFAS reiterated concerns about the agency in the wake of their revelations in Massachusetts. In a statement about the testing on Tuesday, December 1st, Food and Water Watch Executive Director Vino Hatter declared that these findings shock the conscience. States likely have unknowingly contaminated communities' water with PFAS hidden in pesticides. Once again, the EPA has failed to protect the American people from harmful pollution. Emphasizing that we need to stop the introduction of toxic forever chemicals into the environment and the water sources to protect public health, Carter said that EPA must ban all pesticides with PFAS components, designate PFAS as hazardous substances to hold polluters accountable for cleanup of contamination, and set strong, enforceable standards for PFAS in the drinking waters in the U.S. the GOP-controlled Senate must step up and pass the PFAS Action Act, which passed the House in January to regulate these toxic compounds and hold polluters accountable. And U.S. Congress must pass the Water Act to provide the financial relief to community water providers and households which wells to remove PFAS from drinking water or find alternative sources where treatment fails, she added. Now is the time for decisive action to protect people's health and safety.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, treating poverty. Teaching people to believe truly that provision comes from Allah and that He is the provider, Ar-Razzaq, and every calamity that Allah decrees is for a reason, and that the poor Muslim should be patient in bearing his calamity and strive to relieve himself and his family of poverty. Allah says, verily, Allah is the all-provider, owner of power, the most strong. This is chapter 51, verse number 58. Then another place Allah says, and no moving or living creature is there on earth, but its provision is due from Allah, and He knows its dwelling place and its deposit in the uterus or grave. Then Allah says, He it is who has made the earth subservient to you, that is, easy for you to walk, to live, and to do agriculture on it. So walk in the path thereof and eat of His provision, and to Him will be the resurrection. This is chapter 67, verse number 15. Brothers and sisters, we need to realize that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in charge. We need to do the needful, we need to make an effort, and we need to fulfill our responsibility, but in reality it's Allah who provides us with sustenance. It's not our efforts alone. It's not our struggles alone. It's not our academics alone. It's not my job. It's not my paycheck. Allah is the one who provides the provisions to all the creatures and not just to human beings. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing treating poverty, and we said reliance on Allah and knowing in reality that if we fulfill our responsibility, Allah will take care of us. This is what we are discussing. Now, Allah has granted the poor a share of Islamic taxes, which is to be given to the poor to keep, and is to be given until he becomes independent of means and is no longer poor. Generally speaking, it's the responsibility of an Islamic government, of an Islamic system, to collect those taxes and disperse them and distribute them amongst the needy and the poor and the less fortunate people who deserve that help. O you who believe, fear Allah and give up what remains due to you from riba, from now onwards, if you are really believers. The Muslim knows that poverty and richness and whether things are given to one or withheld are all subject to decree of Allah. So he bears hardships with patience when they come, and he thanks Allah, may he be exalted, for good times when he finds them. But he is required to work and seek to earn a living so as to relieve himself and his family of poverty. But if someone is unable to do that because of health reasons or problems in his land, then Islam relieves him of poverty by means of Islamic taxes and charity that are given by the rich. This is the share of their wealth that the poor are entitled to. This is what Islam proposes. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
A new study revealed that per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, a family of potentially toxic chemicals with more than 4,700 known members, have become even more widespread in the environment than previously thought, says Daniel Ross Ryder in an article published under the heading "More traces of cancer-causing PFAS in Arctic raise alarm over global spread." Stay tuned, please, for the details. This July, a new study revealed that per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances known as PFAS, a family of potentially toxic chemicals with more than 4,700 known members, have become even more widespread in the environment than previously thought. The researchers behind the study, which was published in Environmental Science and Technology, detected 11 different PFAS compounds all the way up in the Arctic Ocean, including the first officially confirmed instance of certain relatively newer members of PFAS family in such a remote body of seawater. The new study provides a snapshot into the sheer ubiquity and pervasiveness of these bioaccumulative compounds called forever chemicals because of their stubborn persistence in the environment. Just how widespread are they? We are still learning, but they are appearing in such far-flung places as the polar bears of East Greenland. Back home, the findings of an environmental working group, EWG study, helped lead the nonprofit watchdog organization to posit that PFAFs are probably detectable in all major water supplies in the United States. What's more, over 200 million Americans could be drinking water containing PFAS above a level EWG scientists believe is safe, according to the organization's most recent findings. This is a global problem, said Pamela Miller, executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, an environmental health and justice organization, which released a report last year that confirmed PFAS contamination was present in Alaska at nearly every site investigated where aqueous film-forming foam, a prolific source of PFAS drinking water contamination, had or is currently used. When these chemicals show up in Arctic, something is very wrong, Miller added. Known human health impacts from exposure to some PFAS chemical include certain cancers, liver damage, thyroid problems, and increased risk of asthma. As endocrine disruptors, these chemicals have been linked to increased risk of severe COVID-19. Perhaps the two best-known members of the family, PFOA and PFOS, are no longer manufactured in the U.S. due to the human health risks they pose. But experts fear that global emissions of these chemicals remain elevated due to manufacturing shifts to Asia. What's more, there is a growing body of research to suggest that some of their chemical replacements pose similar human health concerns. Nor are PFAS compounds easy to avoid due to the fact they are found in an array of everyday items such as food packaging, carpets, and clothing. In a common refrain, communities of color and low-income communities appear to be disproportionately impacted by PFAS exposures. Because what goes up must go down. The question that many experts are currently grappling with is this: how exactly are PFAS compounds traveling and being dispersed across the globe? Emerging research suggests that the one important pathway is through the air and in rainwater. Indeed, the Arctic Ocean study published in July speculated that certain PFAS compounds were entering the water from atmospheric sources rather than from ocean circulation. This is a major headache for regulators as they attempt to remove these highly soluble chemicals from the environment, especially bodies of drinking water. Though still fairly limited, current scientific literature points to PFAS compounds entering the atmosphere a variety of ways, like industrial and landfill releases, emissions from treated wastewater and concentrated waste, along with water evaporation. This study suggests that sea spray could be another important possible conduit. At the same time, there remain many unanswered questions surrounding what happens to these chemicals once they're up in the air. How long do they remain there, for example, and how do they behave chemically? How widely dispersed are they, and how many of them are scrubbed out of the atmosphere during a rain event? The bulk of research thus far has focused on rainwater. Last November, Schaeffer and his fellow researchers unveiled at a National Science Symposium in Colorado the findings of a study in which rainwater samples were taken from 30 different sites, primarily on or near the east coast of the U.S. Each example contained at least one of the 36 different compounds being studied. And while the bulk of the samples contain relatively low levels of PFAS, typically less than 1 nanogram per liter, the highest total concentration in a single sample was nearly 5.5 ng per 1. That concentration is above or near potential actionable drinking water thresholds at the state level, with various jurisdictions pursuing much more rigorous drinking water standards than at the federal level, which has a drinking water health advisory level of 70 ng per 1 for combined PFOS and PFOA. Last year, for example, Wisconsin proposed a preventive action limit of 2 ng for combined PFOS and PFOA. A growing number of institutions are plunging into the PFAS issue, seeking a better understanding of the problem's pervasiveness. Researchers out of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, spent a year collecting wet and dry disposition samples at a variety of locations across the state. Dry disposition is particulate matter too heavy to remain airborne. While the findings are currently undergoing peer review before publication, Ralph Mead, professor at UNCW, was able to share some details. Throughout 2019, Turpin and her fellow researchers studied 34 separate PFAS compounds at 5 separate sample sites in North Carolina, each a distance from any known PFAS source. The findings are currently undergoing peer review before publication, but Turpin shared a finding. There is a seasonal variability in different PFAS compounds and levels detected, which provides researchers another useful avenue of pursuit as they look skyward for answers. Indeed, separate studies from Canada, the UK, and Germany found that atmospheric levels of certain PFAS compounds were typically higher indoors than outdoors. They're not natural in the environment. They are made to be in consumer products, Turpin said, pointing to everyday items like carpets and furniture. That's why concentrations are actually higher indoors than outdoors. Schaeffer also outlined a series of ongoing and future PFAS-related studies, one of which comprises the monitoring of 4 wastewater treatment facilities in Wisconsin. Already underway, the aim of this study is to better understand how these plants play a role in releasing PFAS chemicals into the water, earth, and air, as well as to learn about any chemical transformations that these compounds undergo throughout the various treatment processes. The NADP, the EPA, and state environmental agencies have also initiated a 2-year rainwater monitoring program in eastern states. What Schaeffer calls the most long-term focused study for PFAS the nation ever done. Weekly samples will be taken at sites located in North Carolina, New Jersey, New York, and Maine. Why is such a broad geographic network of monitors necessary? A study of PFAS releases from certain manufacturing plants in North Carolina indicated long-range atmospheric transport and disposition in rainwater of PFAS in eastern U.S., said Schaeffer. Scientists have found that there is some unique compounds that came out of some of those manufacturing facilities in North Carolina, and they can trace it in the sediment all the way up to New Hemisphere. Interestingly, the EPA will also be conducting what is called a non-targeted analysis of the rainwater sample at Schefer. In other words, they will be looking at a broad array of PFAS compounds, potentially thousands, in the collected rainwater rather than targeting just a relatively small number. It's scary how these chemicals are appearing in the environment, said Tasha Stoiber, a senior scientist with EWG. It has the potential to just be basically everywhere. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Having competent managers and benefiting from capacities are necessary conditions for economic blossoming.
I want to say to the Iranian nation that because of some problems in the economic situation and in the people's livelihood conditions, some individuals have used the opportunity to fabricate negative stories, saying things such as nothing can be done in any way. Some people are like this. Some individuals in cyberspace, in our press and primarily, and unfortunately in foreign propaganda networks, use the problems that the people face as a means to portray a completely dark picture of the things conveying the feeling that nothing can be done. However, I will tell you that this is not all the case. With its domestic capacities and capabilities, our economy can be one of the most prospering economies in the region and even in the world. We have many capacities. We have numerous resources. And using these resources does not require any miracle whatsoever. These are the issues which could be resolved by officials and managers with determination, a sense of responsibility, and great endeavor.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Condition for this is to have strong and anti-corruption management in the country, as well as comprehensive economic plan. If these things exist, then these capacities should be exploited. The World Bank experts are saying now, it is not what we claim, rather this is being said by well-known and first-tier economists in the world, working as experts for the World Bank, that Iran's economy is 18th among the best economies in the world. In other words, we are the 18th economy among 200 plus countries in the world, and that has been achieved despite the current sanctions and numerous problems. They say that if untapped capacities are used, later on, I will mention these capacities, Iran's economy will move up 6 spots, rising to the 12th position. This is a very important point. With an 80 plus million population, and despite all these problems that others have imposed on us, sanctions and the like, the country is thankfully alive and up and running, and it is also the 18th economy in the world. This is not a minor achievement. We should pay attention to this.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.